104.3 KTOO Juneau. Welcome to Juneau Afternoon on this Monday. I'm Rhonda McBride, your host for this hour, and we are off to a great start today. Ernestine Hayes was called a living, breathing, storytelling treasure as she received one of the Rasmussen Foundation's top honors. We'll talk with this Thlinkit writer about what gives her work such power. Why this Wednesday's full lunar eclipse is one of the biggest celestial events of the year, and how to listen, not just watch for birds. And what kind of weather do we have for watching birds? Tonight, cloudy skies with scattered rain showers, more numerous later into the night, east winds, lows in the mid-40s, and tomorrow highs in the mid-50s, and another day of mostly cloudy skies, otherwise scattered showers. Juneau Afternoon will be right back after National Native News. You're listening to Juneau Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride, and thank you for being here with us today as we celebrate a Juneau writer who was named the Rasmussen Foundation's Distinguished Artist of the Year. Ernestine Hayes, a professor, best known for her books Blonde Indian and Tao of Raven. She was honored on Friday in a virtual ceremony that began with words from Hune Lance Twitchell, one of her colleagues at the University of Alaska Southeast.
Ernestine Hayes, wasa achtu yake yidlari ya yaki. Conahoi exahan. Ya at she a ya. At kautushi hetra ach yeti. Achshukwa yeti. Scoot a dach ayawe at she. My name is Hune, and I'm coming to you from the land of the Occoquan people here in Juneau, Alaska. I'm so happy for you, Ernestine Hayes. You're a writer of incredible power and importance. There's no one who is more deserving of a recognition for being one of the state's finest artists. I had the honor of working with you, trying to start little revolutions, trying to keep big revolutions going. You're a constant source of inspiration, and I'd like to share this song with you.
And that song, Hune Lance Twitchell says, has words about throwing your troubles into the water and emerging from the icy waters reborn. Adam Gibbons, a Rasmussen board member, thanked Hayes for having the courage to share what has been a painful life's journey, from the challenges of discrimination as a child to surviving homelessness.
You are a living, breathing, storytelling treasure, an author, a poet, a professor, a little blonde granddaughter, and a grandmother. Your storytelling talent is a treasure.
I have recently faced that my journey of marginalization began in my earliest years. The little girl I write about was excluded from both cultures in territorial Alaska. I had one friend in whose home I was welcome. Her name was Willa. This life pattern continued throughout my childhood, throughout my years in California, and throughout my life after I returned. I came to accept exclusion as a feature of my life path. However, this generosity, this recognition, this acceptance, this honor overwhelms me and has taught me that I am part of a community that embraces me. You have given me a gift that fulfills the deep need I've lived with since I was that marginalized little girl. I feel your acceptance. I feel accepted. Gunarchish. Gunarchish.
And Gunarchish Ernestine Hayes for being with us today to tell us a little more about this extraordinary recognition that you've received. And of course, it's one of many because you've also been a writer laureate, among other things. But I know that you were pretty overwhelmed and pretty much just cried through the whole ceremony. How are you feeling now?
I was feeling pretty good until you played that, and now I'm crying again.
Well, I hope they are tears of joy because this is very joyful. You know, maybe for starters, you could just tell us a little bit about your life for those of us who may not have been able to read your books, but tell us about your journey and how it came to be a part of your writing.
Well, I was born in Territorial Alaska at the end of the Second World War, and when I was 15, my mother and I moved to California, and I stayed there for 25 long years, and I never came home. And finally, when I turned 40, my sons were either living with their father or grown, and I decided to come home no matter what. It took me 8 months to get from San Francisco to Ketchikan, and I lived in my car, stood in food lines, slept in shelters, camped out in Ketchikan, and finally made it home after 2 years. And I came to believe that journey of leaving and coming back, of distance and return, was one of the primary themes of my life, and that structured my first book.
You know, you've got some excerpts from your books to read to us, and so we would just love to have you share some passages with us. Why don't you start with Blonde Indian? So that was your first book.
Yes, I'll be happy to. I chose this first one because I wanted to emphasize that I was marginalized and excluded right from the beginning of when I was sent out into the world as a kindergarten student. But before that, I didn't realize my position like every child. I just thought the world that I lived in was normal. My mother was diagnosed with tuberculosis not long after I was born. For the first few years, she was an intermittent patient at the public health hospital across the creek from our old house. Every few days, my grandmother walked me through a field of wildflowers and dewdrops to a window in my mother's quarantined world. My mother and her companions, other tubercular native women and their nurses, wore white half masks tied to their faces. They peeked through the window and laughed, their faces framing my mother's hidden smile. Above the masks, their eyes squinted laughter. Beneath the masks, their smiles sparkled through the cotton as they waved. I played in the light rain around the corner from the shady morning side of the building while my grandmother and mother talked. When it was time to go, I said goodbye and watched my mother act out the mask-covered words. I love you. And I waved and smiled back before we left. When you're picking berries, grandmother said, always make noise. That way the bear will go away before you see him. She went about her chores, guiding clothes through the wringer washer, stirring stews of fish or deer meat bubbling on the stove. She showed me how to pick out delicate parts of the fish head, how to peel half-formed salmon berry shoots for a tender new taste of green, how to talk to my cousin, the brown bear. If he comes up to you, don't run. Talk to him. Remind him that you're his cousin. Tell him you only want enough berries for you and your family. Tell him you only want your share. Brown bears and people have often intermarried, hence we are cousins. We must never eat brown bear meat. For us, it would be like eating a person. We must always show respect even when we kill them. Other things should never be killed at all. You should never kill spiders. They're good luck. They protect you. They tell you secrets, she instructed. Never kill a spider. It's lucky when they live in your house. Bears were my cousin, and the wind was my grandfather. I had no sisters or brothers, and I had few friends. But wild plants grew on the hill beside our old house, and a creek led up the mountains behind me, and seaweed and crabs danced in the ocean channel at my feet. I never questioned that I belonged.
And yet, while you felt you belonged in nature, it sounds like it was harder to feel belonged or feel that like you belonged in your own native community as well as in the non-native community.
And I thought, that's very true. Now, I didn't know my father. My mother wasn't married. She was gone to the hospital a lot. My grandparents drank. We were poor. I was often dressed in dirty clothes and hungry. And even when my mother came back, I was undisciplined. I ran wild. I was a little girl that it was not, it's not difficult to understand why other parents during the 1950s didn't really want their children to be too close to me.
Today, with the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, we're hearing more about a lot of the issues that you've raised for a long time, that feeling of being isolated, being treated as the other. Does some of what's going on today in our social scene resonate with you?
Well, without doubt, because we can see that all the institutions that have been placed upon us to oppress us are designed to produce our failure, to produce our isolation, to produce our feelings of inadequacy, because that's what the institutions are meant to do. Even Native education was designed to produce Native failure. And of course, it's successful at what it was designed to do, as are all the institutions, the Western institutions that are based on colonization, are designed to produce the way we feel, the marginalization, the trauma, the grief, the pain. That's what they're meant to do. And understanding that and realizing it and recognizing it is the first huge step. And I think that's where we're at.
Well, through your stories, people say they come to a lot of realizations, especially about how painful some of the things were that people endured. I was just curious as I was reading you, hearing you describe the masks and your mom being isolated because of TB. Does the pandemic bring back feelings of the past for you?
I think that it maybe sees it from a different perspective. I was moved in by that same thought that here we are wearing masks again, and maybe this is a time for a transformation in a good direction. Maybe when we take our masks off this time, it will be to face a better truth.
And so you've got one more passage to read for us from your second book. So I'd love to hear that.
I chose one from Dow of Raven, which I think which shows what happens after we start going to school. We feel included and loved and embraced and part of nature when we're very, very young and still home. But when we're sent into school and Western-based education does its work on us, it doesn't take long for us to feel marginalized. This comes from a day when I was about 12 years old and I was running around on a summer day and my mother had given me her Kodak camera to use. And I ran into some white children from school and we weren't friends, but we recognized each other. And we all went over to the dock and started fishing off the right off the dock outside cold storage. And one of the boys pointed down south on the dock and said, "Look at that drunk Indian coming our way." And it was my grandfather. Everyone tried to be quiet as my grandfather walked toward us. The other children, their derision ill-concealed by poor attempts to cover their snorts of laughter, took hesitant steps backward as my grandfather neared. Finally, we all stood too close to one another, within the distance of a man's height, his reach, his life, the white children I dared to imagine as my friends staging their retreat behind me, ready to dash for the safety of another world, my grandfather in front of me offering a whiskered smile, saluting me with the heavy flatfish he proudly held up for my regard and admiration. I at the torn seam of two worlds, dreams faded like dappling sunlight, the only choice, no choice at all, to embrace the life that had been designed for me, no less than the lives that had been designed by these children's parents for us all, to give back the proud smile my grandfather offered, to know that despite the fish slime, despite the days-old whiskers, despite the headache and lost fingers and sharp grief, here was a man who understood what it meant to be proud. I took his picture and gave him a hug. I admired the salt fresh fish. We both knew he would sell it to some lucky cook and would use the money to buy more wine. We both knew it would take far more than a sunny afternoon for me to make friends of those softened pink children. We both knew that those children's fathers, though they ran the town and ran the schools and ran the courts and ran our lives, would never possess the courage that my grandfather showed every day by simply waking up and going on. We both knew that even though halibut cheeks were my mother's favorite summer meal, and even though there was no chance that we might fry one up tonight, my grandfather loved me as much as any grandfather had ever loved his wild, unreliable, unpredictable grandchild. The next time I saw those children, as we passed each other in the halls of the school designed to exalt them, we didn't speak.
What did it take to pull that out of yourself?
I have to sit at the keyboard and silence myself and allow all those feelings and all those images and all those sensory impressions just to envelop and surround me. And when I face them and confront them, it actually makes me feel stronger.
Did it take you a while in life to put it all together, to realize that it was kind of your life's work to put all these conflicting pieces together? An alcoholic grandfather who you loved and loved you, but maybe you didn't love his behavior?
It took me quite a while to realize even that I had a story to tell. And once I began writing my story and putting it together and fashioning it into a a book-length work that also included my story, but the story of old Tom and young Tom and the bear and the seasons and the fish, I realized that I wasn't just telling my story. I was telling the story of all the Native people in colonized 20th century Alaska, and those of us who lived through the 20th century and are here now are walking wounded in a cultural war, and we are survivors.
Well, when you put it in that context, it becomes a totally different thing, doesn't it? I mean, to walking wounded. And we never stop to think of that, I think, in our day-to-day lives as to how things got to be the way they are. So can I ask, Ernestine, how old are you?
I will be 76 in a little over a month. I was born in 1945.
So when did you start writing?
Well, I always thought of myself as a writer, and I always wrote at things, but I didn't really become a serious writer until I enrolled at the University of Alaska Southeast at the age of 50, and I learned that writing takes a lot of discipline.
And so you're not afraid to start new things, no matter how old you are. What an inspiration that is. So at 76, what are your plans? What are you working on now?
Well, we're hoping to move into the house that burned 3 years ago. I have a really great contractor now, Specialty Renovations. Jay has promised that July will be our move-in date, and I want to set up my computer and find any old notes and books that may have survived the fire and storage and the water damage and begin working on my third book in what I hope will be an Alaska Native trilogy.
Wow. I can't wait to see what comes out of that. And I know that when you were recognized on Friday, that was one of the first things you mentioned is the fire. And of course, this recognition comes with a very hefty stipend, a remarkable stipend. And I could see you were just overwhelmed by that.
Absolutely. It couldn't have come at a better time, because one of the things that had to be done is when I retired, I had to access my whole retirement fund and use it to conduct the repairs on this house, because the negotiations with the insurance company have just lagged for so long. I couldn't wait any longer, so I used pretty much all my retirement. And of course, I owe a lot of taxes on that. And so this is just so perfectly timed. Now I'm meeting the taxes, the storage, the hauling, the refurnishing. It's all going to happen now, and I'm just overjoyed as well as overwhelmed.
Well, your life has been full of these twists and turns, and I remember the scene in Fiddler on the Roof when Tevye, the kind of the patriarch of the family, turns to God, looks up at the sky and says, well, I understand, we are the chosen ones, but why are you always choosing us? Do you sometimes wonder, like, why me, that all these things, a mom with tuberculosis, raised among alcoholics who loved you, but still posed many challenges, a house fire. Do you just sometimes say, why me?
I have learned not to question my path, but I really have also learned not to actually not trust some of my reactions to the challenges on my path. I think I could have made it easier, but I believe that anybody who comes onto my path is either Buddha trying to teach me or Raven trying to trick me.
I guess it's like a two-sided coin, isn't it? So what's your basic philosophy of life in a nutshell?
I've been looking back at my age, I've been looking back at all the patterns and repeating lessons that have come up in my life. And I think just trusting my path is what I'm trying to do now.
Well, you said something earlier when we were talking before we went on the air that you try to always keep one foot in the future. What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, I look in the future when I'm trying to make a decision. I look and put myself like 5 years in the future, and I look back and say, what will I be glad I did or sorry I didn't do? And I remind myself that as old as I am and as old as I feel, this, I will never be as young as I am today. I will never again be this young. And so I just try to motivate myself by reminding myself of that truth.
So you're looking out 5 years from now. What are you seeing?
I'm seeing myself in this house next door that was built in 1906, but is essentially a new house with new wiring, new plumbing and insulation. And my granddaughter is going to be the woman of the house. And I'm going to hand all those daily cares to her because she's more than able to do that. And I'll be writing.
And just before we go, one of the things you mentioned during the ceremony is how proud you are of young people, that they are embracing their culture and language.
Yes, absolutely. Young people will lead us into the future. Young people know what kind of world has been created for them. Young people have a really solid understanding of the brink that we're standing at. And I believe young people are our leaders of today. And I believe that young people will help us decolonize, smash the patriarchy, undo capitalism, and resist.
And how do you feel about how much pride they take in their culture and their and a large number of children who are learning Tlingit?
Absolutely. And Lance Twitchell, I put all the work that he's done and his charisma and his talent and his intelligence has inspired so many children and young people of college and high school age to learn the language. And I really agree with him that that is the basis, the foundation for our future.
Don't you kind of wish that you were born now to experience all of the things that kids are exposed to today?
I would love to be born now, but it would have to be, you know, I don't know if I'd want to be young again because I was such a foolish girl.
But such a wise woman. So I guess the foolishness was necessary to teach you how to be wise, maybe.
I guess that was on my path.
Well, I enjoyed hearing about your path so much today. Thank you for being with us and giving us your time. I know you're much in demand today with all the accolades. So thanks for being with us.
Thanks for the invitation. Gunash Chish.
Gunash Chish. And we're going to end with more of Lance Twitchell's song for you.
Cheese.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
This is Missionera, arranged and performed by Jason Vio, to get you ready for his visit to Juno Afternoon tomorrow. He's in town for the Jazz and Classics Festival, billed as one of the finest classical guitarists of his time. Delaney will get a chance to talk to Jason Vio tomorrow, so you want to be sure to tune in tomorrow. But when we come back, keep your eyes to the skies tomorrow night. Why, there is a chance to see one of the most spectacular full lunar eclipses of the year this week, weather permitting, of course. And just a correction here, this is Felicidad, not Missionero, but also by Jason Vio, and tomorrow he will be here in our studios to talk to Shelley Delaney, so don't miss out.
An open road doesn't mean you own the road, so not so fast. Law enforcement officers are looking for drivers just like you, going over the speed limit. When they pull you over, you should thank them, because they may have just saved your life. If you're thinking you're saving time, think again. Driving 10 miles over the speed limit only saves a few minutes. Drive the speed limit and arrive alive. Paid for by the Alaska Highway Safety Office.
Support comes from Nugget Alaskan Outfitter, providing a curated selection of goods from sunglasses to rain gear to live, work, and play in Southeast. Open Monday through Friday, 10 to 8, Saturday, 10 to 6, Sunday, noon till 5 at the Mendenhall Mall.
You are listening to Juno Afternoon. It is so good to have all of you here with us today. I'm Rhonda McBride. Well, tomorrow night, look to the skies. Hopefully they will be clear enough so you can see what's called a superflower blood moon. And that's going to be followed this week by a full eclipse that will look larger than normal, probably the most spectacular full moon of the year. Well, to explain all the science behind this, we turn to Juno's own Marie Drake Planetarium, where Steve Kosas is a dedicated volunteer. Now, I know, Steve, it is frustrating to have all these big celestial events happen, and we never know for sure if the weather is going to permit us to see them. Are you keeping your eye on the weather closely?
Well, I'm just a persistent observer. This is Steve Kosas. I'm a board member of the Marie Drake Planetarium. Let me just mention weather. The last interesting celestial event was the conjunction of Saturn and Jupiter. And the closest approach was 10 minutes of arc, about a third of the diameter of the full moon, on December 21st. And during that period, it was very, very cloudy. But I went out every night. And December 21st, around 10 p.m., the clouds parted for me, and I saw the Jupiter-Saturn conjunction when it was at its best. So no matter how bad the weather is, there's always a chance that it may clear up.
So you're ever hopeful. But let's say, for example, that the weather doesn't clear up. Do you have some other options to maybe watch it online or some other things you might recommend to some of us?
Yeah, the timeanddate.com is doing a live stream of this lunar eclipse, which is, for our time, is going to happen early Wednesday morning. The partial eclipse will start around 1 a.m. Wednesday morning, May 26th. And the moon will actually set when it's still in eclipse. So max eclipse, when the moon is totally in the Earth's umbra, the darkest part of the shadow, will be from around 3:11 a.m. to 3:25 a.m. Wednesday morning. So I'll be up.
I think we can count on that. So what is this super flower blood moon? This is the opening act for the eclipse?
Well, these are slang terms. The super moon, which is a slang term, I think it's been around for about 5 years. The moon does not have a circular orbit around the Earth. It has an elliptical orbit. So at times it's closer and other times further away. So this full moon, May 26th, the moon will be at its closest approach to the Earth. It's called perigee, and it'll be about 10% larger than usual. So the average size of the full moon is about half a degree of arc, 30 minutes. So this full moon, the moon will be about 33 minutes of arc. So just to say what that's like, if you hold your arm out at arm's length, your index finger is a degree of arc. So the moon's like half of your index finger at arm's length. That's the actual size of the moon in the sky. So that's what the supermoon means, that the moon is in an elliptical orbit and is closer to the Earth.
So
the other part...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, the flower part has to do that this lunar eclipse is part of a series of four eclipses. This lunar eclipse is going to be followed by an annular solar eclipse, June 10th. And two other lunar eclipses. So it's a four, a tetrad. So that's kind of the flower petals. That's where that. And the blood moon is another term. What the blood moon is that when you have a total lunar eclipse during totality, the sun's rays go through the Earth's atmosphere and the blues and the violets and indigos are filtered out. They're the short wavelength. So the long wavelength light rays, the reds and the oranges, don't get filtered out. It's called, the physics term for it is Rayleigh scattering. So it's like a billion sunsets all at once, and it gives the moon a reddish, copperish color, orange color. That's where the blood moon. So there's blood moon, the super moon, and the flower moon. They're all kind of slang, but it has to do with this particular eclipse. It's going to be closer than normal, and we'll be seeing also this eclipse. The moon's very close to the edge of the umbra, the edge of the Earth's shadow. So we'll be getting more light coming through the Earth's atmosphere. So it'll be kind of a light red color.
So is this back-to-back of a super blood moon followed by a full eclipse? Is that all unusual?
Not necessarily. There's typically... The last time we saw a total lunar eclipse here in Juno was about 2 years ago. But that's because you just see it in different places of your surface. So typically there's like two lunar eclipses a year, and typically around one or two total solar eclipses a year. So new moon, there'll be a total, there'll be an annular eclipse of the sun, but it won't be visible here.
So where do you go to watch these celestial events if the weather permits?
If the weather permits, okay, that's the preface for Juno. Well, this particular lunar eclipse, it occurs in the early morning and it's going to be very low on the horizon. The moon will actually be setting in eclipse. So when the partial eclipse starts, the moon will be around 10 degrees above the horizon, which if you hold your fist out at arm's length, that's about 10 degrees. So you have to position yourself somewhere here in Juno where you can see 10 degrees above the horizon. So to answer the question, where would that be? Two locations that would satisfy that would be North Douglas and out at the Airport Dyke Trail, or also out at the Glacier Visitor Center if you go up the little ramp there. So I gave away the three locations where it's visible. So
we might see you out there at one of those locations. So while we have you here, what's coming up at the Marie Drake Planetarium? I know that with COVID, you've kind of been operating in a more small scale way.
Well, we haven't been really operating other than our YouTube channel. We purchased a brand new projector a year ago through donations, Rasmussen and the Blackwell and Core Alaska. And we did four published shows with our new projector. We're very pleased with the new projector. Then, like all the other nonprofit groups, we had to shut down. So possibly this fall, we'll start doing public shows again with our new projector. And our shows are all free, astronomy education for the public. So this fall, we don't have a date yet, we'll probably start doing our shows again with our new projector.
So what about your Earth Day videos? I know that the last time you were on Juno Afternoon, you and your wife were encouraging people to submit videos to celebrate Earth Days. Did you get a lot of response from that?
Yeah, Christina, my wife, she's the president of the board for the planetarium. She's putting that together, so we'll put those on the YouTube channel when we have them in a suitable format. So we're still working on that. We haven't published them yet on our YouTube channel.
So did you get quite a few people that sent in their videos?
We got around eight, so we're working on those.
Okay, well, that's great. Well, before we go, is there anything else you want to let us know about coming up with a planetarium?
Well, just that keep posted. Like I said, we'll probably start doing public shows again in the fall, and it'll be on our website, MarieDrakePlanetarium.org, and our Facebook page, Marie Drake Planetarium, for when we start doing shows again. And our new projector is just fantastic. It's state-of-the-art, and it's all digitized. So, and we're working on shows now. The system came with its own scripting language, so we can write programs. You push the button, and it'll run the whole show. But we'll always be doing interactive shows when we start going public again.
Well, thanks very much, Steve, for telling us about what to expect with this lunar eclipse that comes on early Wednesday morning. And
also, 3 in the morning is max eclipse, Wednesday morning.
I somehow don't think I'm going to be up to see that, but it's nice to know that you will and can report back to us if need be.
I'm a pensioner, so.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Steve Kosis.
Yeah, thanks, Rhonda.
With the Marie Drake Planetarium. This is Jason Vio, a classical guitarist playing Duke Ellington. And Jason Vio is here for the Juno Jazz and Classics Festival. And he'll be joining us in our studios tomorrow with Shelley Delaney. And I understand he's going to be bringing his guitar with him. So you won't want to miss that show, because from what I am hearing from the Juno Jazz and Classics Festival organizers, a lot of the in-person appearances for Jason Vio have been sold out. So there's just some community events left. So Tomorrow with Shelley might be your best chance to hear some Jason VO. That sounds so peaceful. Jason VO. He is going to be our guest tomorrow on Juno Afternoon. But for now, don't go to sleep just yet. I know that music was very soothing. But we have something to wake you up here. Some other kind of music from the natural world. Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Apologies about last Friday. We had some technical problems and we were unable to bring you our weekly birdwatch segment. But Brenda Wright with the Juno Audubon Society has graciously consented to come back and join us now to talk about some of the birds that are out there right now, as well as what they sound like, because that's going to help you spot them, because sometimes they're hard to see in the greenery. So, Brenda, I guess we always start off talking about what is it that you're particularly seeing right now?
Well, every day is something new. This is the best time of year for birding. There's a new warbler. There's a flycatcher. Some of the birds that we see all winter are leaving us. So we see their wings beating away.
Yeah, I guess you got to be on top of it to catch it all. Is there any bird that's been with us for a while that's in an interesting phase to observe?
Yes, that's really interesting, because in winter, a lot of birds become very, a little bit drab. But right now, all the males are getting all spiffed up to show off to the ladies to make sure that they find their true sweetheart.
Sounds very, very romantic. Well, speaking of romantic, we always hear about Harlequin romances. Is that how the Harlequin duck got its name?
You know, it's a very brilliantly colored bird, and it really does look like the Harlequin mask that they used in France. So that's where it got its name.
Well, you know, you have given me some sounds of these birds, and this one I kind of listened to and I said, is this a bird or some kind of squeaky toy? So let's listen. Brenda, yep. It's not a very melodic bird, is it?
Well, people often describe it as mouse-like. Mouse-like squeaking.
And that's a duck.
That's a duck.
So it doesn't have a whack, but a squeak, squeak.
Nope. It talks a lot, and so it really helps you hone in to look for it. It leaves us to go to find the fastest rapids up high in the mountains that it can find, and lives in the Cascades to have its babies. But all winter, it stays around us at all the points that have the highest surf and the most wave action. That's where they live all winter with us.
I didn't realize that they were, year-round or winter residents in Juneau. What about the Stellar J? Now, you have given us some sound from that. Shall I go ahead and play it?
He's a year-round resident. Yes, please.
He just sounds like he's complaining.
You know, they're not, you know, especially after listening to the guitar, you notice how non-melody-like they are.
yeah, they're more, the Harlequins and the Stellar Jays are just noisemakers, I think.
Well, the Stellar is it's a corvid, and it's very, very bright. It's very smart. You can't get away with anything with it, and it likes to rule the neighborhood, and that's why it makes those kind of noises. If it sees some bird that it doesn't like, it's going to tell us, this is my neighborhood, you got to move out.
but they are pretty birds.
They are. They are very pretty.
So what is their pattern in Juneau?
They live here with us year round. They beg us for peanuts in the winter and tell us where to plant our seeds in the summer so they can get them out of the garden before they can germinate. and watch us all the time to make sure that we're doing things correctly.
Yeah, I guess it's interesting that each of these birds has their own personality. So our last bird to watch this week is the tree swallow. So I'm going to go ahead and play that bird sound. That's a little bit sweeter.
Yes, it is. And they do that a lot while they're flying. And they have such tiny little legs that they really can't hardly do anything standing up. So even to get a drink of water, they fly really close to a pond and just take a sip as they're flying.
So,
but they're one of our best summer birds, because birds that eat mosquitoes are our favorites.
Right. So unlike the Stellar Jays, who are neighborhood bullies, the swallows are public servants, so to speak.
Yes. Yes, they are very much so. And luckily for us, we actually have four kinds of swallows here. But the tree swallows are most often seen of places like the Pioneer Marsh or Twin Lakes, or places that are open grasslands where the bugs are thick and the breeze is calm.
So before we go, any final bird watching thoughts?
Yes, we do have last week we were suggesting you go to Dredge Lake, and that's still a really great place to go. The warblers are there in the alders, and if you can't see them, you can at least hear all of them. There's several interesting ducks on the lakes, and there's a huge flock of tree swallows and a couple other unusual swallows around Crystal Lake. There's some redheads and even a couple kinds of flycatchers that we seldom see here. And we like flycatchers too, because they eat mosquitoes also.
All righty. Well, thank you very much, Brenda, for joining us for Juneau Afternoon.
Thank you, Rhonda.
Support for Juneau Afternoon is provided by Hanson Gress, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, and Klingit and Haida Social Enterprises. For more information, visit ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon.
And thank you for joining us for Juneau Afternoon. We really appreciate you being here with us and hope that all of you have a great afternoon and evening. Thanks.